The next case is 98-2016, City of Maumee versus Glenn White. Justice Resnick has recused herself in this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in the place of Justice Resnick, Judge Donna Bowman, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 10th District. Mr. Arnby.
Okay, please report. Good morning. My name is John Arnby. I represent the appellant in this case, the City of Maumee. At this time, we would suspect that we request 1 minute for rebuttal.
So the officer that made the stop did not talk to the person who called in. He then followed this vehicle that was described by the caller, and I can't remember from the record where the caller went to. I don't know if the caller followed the police or left or what. It said it was there when the police came, but after the train went by and the stop and so forth. I don't know where the caller went to, if the caller was ever talked to. Now, the officer followed this car. The officer did not observe any condition that would indicate that the driver was doing anything wrong. Is that correct?
In part.
What's the part I'm missing?
He did follow the vehicle. As to the condition, I believe the officer testified he did not see any erratic driving, nothing unusual about the driving.
Had he not had the information from the dispatcher, he wouldn't have stopped the car.
That is correct. The condition that the officer focused seriously on in this case was the condition of the traffic, condition of the roadway at the time. He said there was very heavy traffic, there had just been a train. And he was concerned that he not stopped based upon the information provided by the caller. He was afraid of public safety.
Well,
something may occur.
I understand. But outside of what he was told by the dispatcher, he had no knowledge whatsoever of the condition of the driver.
That is correct.
He pulled the driver over. And then I guess after that he determined that through testing and talking with him that the driver failed the test at the scene, did he? So prior to the stop, he had no information on his own of anything wrong in that car. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
That is correct.
Let me ask you about the White case. There, as you know, the Supreme Court found it significant that the caller was able to predict the conduct of the defendant and predict it accurately. It would show up in a certain type of car at a certain location. Here, that element is missing, isn't it? And I guess, assuming that you agree with me that element is missing, what significance of that is that?
The significance of the predictability,
right,
and not knowing.
Well, in White, as you know, one of the elements that the court relied upon was the fact that the tipster was able to say the person is going to go to a certain place, be there at a certain time, in an identified car. Here, the tipster says this person's weaving, and the assumption from that is that if the officer observed that car, he'd probably see it weaving also, which of course didn't occur here. So my question is, we're trying to develop a test, obviously, for officers and others to use. What value would you place in the fact that the defendant here did not act the way the tipster had seen him acting? Does that make a difference?
I don't think it makes a difference in this case, because the same officer, you can never predict 100% of the time. The officer had to rely upon that information just from sort of his perspective. What he had in saying, how reliable is this information? Can I rely upon this information? He had other facts available to him that I believe established reliability in this case, not only believing, but the officer had a very detailed description of the vehicle, the location of the vehicle, the color, make, model, direction of travel. The officer was right on top of that. I think the end result of cases the officer was attempting to incur or stop in this case, or at least that attempt to be.
Let's say that all of the information that the officer had to stop the gentleman. No order of alcohol, no problem. The guy said, I'm sorry, my son was acting up and I was trying to control him. I believe the officer said, all right, just be careful. What is the harm versus the officer not stopping because we might rule a lot that that's not good enough? The guy goes off and has an accident on the very first week that the officer did.
You're exactly right. In that the officer pulls someone over and sees someone that the child is acting up and quite not a child. In that situation, that intrusion is very minimal. The officer says, we had a report, driving bad, you see a record problem. Please point your way. I think that's what happened in this case. Had the officer not had an indicia of the appearance of alcohol in a person who was consuming. In that case, we get down primarily in our argument is the balancing factor, weighing the intrusion into the privacy interest versus the government's state, the government interest in allowing stops of this nature. And when we balance the fact, what is the state's interest in this case? It's long recognized in case law that says we need to stop drunk driving, and there's Michigan versus SIPs approved. The idea of sporadic checkpoints, we have numerous laws by the state regarding DUI enforcement. In 1997, we have over 327,000 cases for crashes involving alcohol. In that year, there were 16,000 deaths in alcohol-related crashes. The privacy interest of the appellant, or the appellee in this case, is our position is very minimal. It was a temporary brief stop check on his condition. If there was nothing wrong with him, I am confident the officer would have said, go on your way. He was not detained, had enough, had nothing wrong with him. Detention was very minimal, probably a minute or two, maybe checking the status of his license, if even that. Most likely not, just would have said, have a nice day. I think the officer is incumbent. In this case, when you get a report of a erratic driver, stop and find out what is the condition of that driver. In this situation, the driver, aside from being intoxicated, he could have been ill, could have been having a heart attack, having a diabetic reaction. We don't know what the cause of that erratic driving was, so a brief stop and attention. Look into that, I believe it's reasonable. In the state's interest, I believe seriously outweighed the defendant's privacy interest, at least in this particular case. The alternative, like I think that we look at, what is the alternative that the officer could have done? The alternative, the officer could have sat back and watched and waited to see what would happen in that driver.
I suppose he could have followed him longer, too, couldn't he?
Yeah. He could have followed him longer.
He followed for 20 to 40 seconds. That's not a lengthy period of time. I mean, he could follow him longer.
Right.
And the odds are that the driver's going to weave. If he's that drunk, he's going to eventually weave again. Your argument is, well, he might weave into somebody else. That's right, but that's our way, I guess.
Could have been extremely disappointed. I've never could have been extremely dangerous. Could have been a fatal decision by the officer. And then we're going to open up a whole other door as to why the officer didn't effectuate the stop. Why did the officer sit back? You know, what liability? I don't know if any the police department have in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a reported drunk driver or a report of someone erratic on your roadway in the city of Maumee, you didn't take action. Then the guy continues through the city of Maumee.
Should we judge this sort of Fourth Amendment issue differently because we think that the officer could have followed a bit longer and obtained some independent evidence or not and let the fellow go? should we judge that sort of scenario differently than we should judge a scenario which likewise would involve a tip from a cell phone of a nearby motorist saying the car next to me, the guy's waving a gun. And he's waving the gun, and then the officer approaches, no gun. I mean, do we approach these both the same way, or should there be different law for different, how exigent the circumstances are?
I think we have to look at each case. I'm not going to easily have a case. Mm-hmm. I think each case has to turn on facts.
And then you don't have much of a rule, do you?
No, you do not. In that situation, we are not here today. This is the city of Vietnam. I was the Attorney General's office as well. But that's important to come up with a bright line rule as to what must be done in this situation. We're not asking for that. Every case is our position. Turns on its own facts. It turns on its own facts.
I think you are arguing for a rule that says you have a reliable tip from a cell phone caller.
Should the analysis be whether or not it's an anonymous tip, or whether or not that it's not anonymous? This is an informant who's not anonymous. Is that?
I mean, because we haven't seen a face.
What's your argument that we have to? The phone number makes them not anonymous, or
how many factors do we have to have? We have to have a name,
phone number, address. You know, what is it? Is it anonymous when someone calls in on the phone and gives their name?
The anonymous factor, you raise to another level, at least when a person calls in and gives them a name. I believe that's not true. If a person calls in and says, my name is Stephen Carney, I am behind a car,
I think it's there.
And Stephen Carney who's calling in.
So it's not anonymous. I mean, the law deals with anonymous.
Because he took steps to identify himself, put himself at the scene, described driving, and provided, I think, as much reliable information as he could. I don't believe in this case this address or an address, but I don't know what more the officer could have requested to determine whether or not this person is anonymous.
So you're saying we're going to throw away probable cause for the officer if he has a phone call from the dispatcher saying that they had a phone call from someone who observed this car. We throw it out in those circumstances. Is that it? In all other circumstances, we still have to have probable cause. Is that it?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Usually, we ask the officer, now, what did you observe that car doing that would allow you to stop and investigate, correct? So they say, well, he went across the yellow line three or four times, he hit the curb once, and he was speeding. So there was something wrong, and he saw that. Now, we're going to forfeit that requirement if we have information from a caller and we know their name and phone number.
Well,
yes, you are, because you said the officer didn't observe anything wrong with the car. So you want us to forfeit those requirements in certain situations?
In certain situations.
Because the need is greater, or what?
The need is greater. I think we have to look at the extendency of the circumstances what it's been reported, but also the officer has to take into consideration the totality of the circumstances, just as what the court does when it makes it.
Did the officer call in the license number of the car he was following to determine whether he had ever been arrested for DWI before?
I hope not. No, I don't believe so.
Or when he stopped, don't the police check the number and see if there's any wants or arrest warrants out for the owner of the car? Don't they do that?
I would say we can do that after we submit this to my turn.
After they get the information from the driver.
That is correct.
I see.
You have 30 seconds in rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Sadowski. They do make a point, I think a little overstated, that this is going to kill the grab DUI program. Really, it doesn't do that at all. It seems to me it may diminish it some, because if we adopt the defendant's view, because the officer would not be able to stop under these conditions, but it certainly gives the dispatcher and the police information about somebody who, if the officer observe them long enough, it's likely they'll see them committing at least some drunk driving, maybe not the gun or other things. But that's your point about the grab DUI, that that's still a viable program, even if we were to affirm.
Correct, Your Honor. The way I see grab DUI works, what it does is it gives law enforcement the opportunity to get in a position that they wouldn't have been in but for the cyber call. They still get in that position. There's a driver on such and such road, here's the plate, the number, here's this plate. The police officer can go get in a position behind him, and he, based upon his expertise, his training, his experience, can make a determination whether that's reasonable suspicion to pull them over. The program is not diminished at all by requiring the officer to do that. Another important fact in this case is that the cellular caller didn't have any personal contact or any knowledge of any alcohol consumption, didn't see any beer cans, never had any contact with a public advisor and his sort of speech or fear.
Well, that's usually the case with the officer who follows a drunk driver, too. They don't know about the slurred speech. They don't know. They just see the erratic driving. That's always the indication. I mean, that's all anybody has.
That is correct. But I propose that an officer is trained, and they are very well trained, to discern what is related to alcohol-related driving. I believe that all officers are trained to look for certain things. It doesn't have to be a week out of their way. It's just certain things in their life.
But the report from this informant tracks exactly what we hear in suppression hearings, that erratic driving, weaving, you know, that's what the officers always say at suppression hearings, exactly the language they use, isn't it?
I don't know about every suppression hearing. I have heard it before. But I also, again, I would say that the police officers train to make a determination whether to leave the state upon changing the radio.
Okay.
Whether we leave the state upon using your own cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And when he took He didn't rely.
There's weaving and there's weaving.
Okay. He didn't rely upon the sight of Paul. What he did was he followed him for over 30 or 40 seconds. He took away the reliability of the call because he then independently observed nothing. If he would have got it right behind him, that argument may have been way.
Well, I don't understand that. If it hadn't been for the call, he wouldn't have stopped it, would he? Would the officer have stopped the defendant driving along without weaving?
Absolutely not, and that's what the officer testified. He further testified that he didn't believe that Sally Weiser was any threat to the safety of other drivers, any greater threat than any other driver in the world that day.
Oh, I thought you said he didn't rely on this on the call.
I'm sorry. Well, with regards to reliability, a citizen witness and this argument on citizen witness. The problem with the citizen witness argument is that what it does is it says that we're going to take a citizen witness' definition of reasonable suspicion over a police officer. We're going to have them be the determining factor of what reasonable suspicion is. Because when we get into our suppression hearing, we're not going to produce that. We're going to rely on the dispatch to have the suppression hearing. We don't challenge what the reasonable suspicion was now. Because the officer, on a normal suppression hearing, the officer would testify as to what his reasonable suspicion was. We take it in the context of every citizen witness that calls in and gives a version of weaving, then that's the reasonable suspicion. It's not for the same scrutiny when an officer raises his own reasonable suspicion, he goes into suppression hearing and challenges.
I'm not real clear on the suppression here. I know it's a bit of a side issue here. What value in your view would have been added to the state position if the citizen informer had been brought to suppression here to indicate what he observed? Different case of that.
I think it changed, not necessarily a completely different case, but I think it does change the nature of the case. What it does is about the opportunity and the judge the opportunity to determine whether what they witnessed was in fact reasonable suspicion. They now need to come and describe it just like an officer would. Did they go across three lanes of traffic? Did they drift within their lane? Basically, we hold them the same scrutiny as an officer, and I think that would change the case. I don't know if it would make a completely different case. The other argument that a person, a citizen witness, is deemed reliable because they are putting themselves at the mercy of potential liability, completely without merit. If you take the fact of this case, this person said that they observed otherwise weaving. There's no way that we can ever come back and say, no, they weren't weaving at that one second that you saw them weaving, and we're not able to prove them reliable.
Should this rule of law turn on the level of exigency of the circumstances, my scenario about the gun, somebody in an occupant of a car waving a gun, appearing to take aim at nearby, let's say, other folks in their lane, and an officer, but the same deal, officer doesn't observe that when he comes up. Should the rule of law be any different because it's potential problem with drunk driving, whereas it's more dangerous with a gun, somebody aiming a gun?
I think it should, because the reason the officer is pulling the person over in the gun scenario is that they do have a gun. The reason the officer is...
How do they know? They only know the gun, same thing about the weaving. How's it any different than weaving? We only know that someone said on a cell phone that they had a gun, and the officer doesn't see a gun.
Well, the threat here to safety in our scenario is the weaving.
Mm-hmm.
And the officer can witness the weaving. Or as opposed to the other situation, I don't think he can witness the gun without pulling him over and actually discerning whether there is a gun in the car.
So it's a confirmation, the ability to confirm the tip that you distinguish between the two. The officer is able to confirm weaving by following for some distance, whereas they wouldn't be able to. That should be the ability to confirm it.
I believe that is one factor that should be looked at. I think there's many ways that this court can go on this case. There's so many different issues. There can be a bright line rule. They can set standards, and they can set rules and operation that the law enforcement has to abide by. It surprises me that the officer says that they don't want that bright line rule. Because we see a value in that. We see a value in telling the officers
what they can and cannot do. Right now, across the state, it is all over the board, and it is the appellate court is what they can and cannot do in this situation.
Counsel, what city should the sheriff and the deputy then follow? 5 minutes.
Position with the sobriety checkpoints that the U.S. Supreme Court has found to be lawful. Where there's not even a telephone call. There's a public notice that if you drive while drinking, you're going to be slapped.
Yes,
if they
not
sleep.
Not everyone would stop under this law or this theory would be drinking. If you reach over and adjust the seatbelt.
Just like the sobriety checkpoints.
Based upon all those arguments, we would just ask the appellate court decision be upheld. And based on the facts of this case, or upon any bright lines, and there's other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Budowski. Mr. Attorney, Mr. Ernest, you say, well, you get 30 seconds to say.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, we'd just like to confirm a few things quickly. First, whatever the reliability of the tip or the informant, it makes no difference at all how much of the information was held by one police officer, the dispatcher, or the other police officer who's out doing the arrest. That's the case law is clear. This court and the U.S. Supreme Court, they look at the knowledge of the officers as a whole. So if there's enough to go on, and the dispatcher thinks there's enough to go on, the dispatcher can say, Tim, pull that guy over now, I'll fill you in later. And that's enough help time and time again. So we do look at the knowledge of the officers as a whole. And here the court below segregated that when they said, well, Officer Roberts didn't get the name until afterward. But the dispatcher had the name and the number, and Officer Roberts knew the dispatcher had that information. The other important point is that the exigent circumstances are built into the balancing test. They are built in when you talk about the nature of the governmental interest. And the nature of the governmental interest, by definition, includes guns or rolling weapons on wheels like a car is here or any sort of thing. For all those reasons, we ask you to reverse the court below and uphold the defense stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion. Marshal, please report.